From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. So today, we continue our newcomers series showcasing some of the brightest new voices in journalism today. This week, we head to Chicago to hear how young people fresh to the workforce are faring in this tough economic climate. Here's reporter Susie Yan.
Eileen Murphy got a job as a human resources contractor for a Chicago consulting firm after she got out of grad school. And about 15 months into her first real job, Murphy got laid off.
At first, I handled it pretty calmly. I sat down, I'm like, what do I need to get ready? So I was very strategic. And then once it all settled in, that's, I think, when I freaked out and I got really worried.
At 25, Murphy joined nearly a quarter of a million people who lost their jobs in November. And the number kept growing. By the end of January, 7.6% of the nation was unemployed, according to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics.
I've never seen this level of anxiety among people and so much, I want to say, hopelessness. Not that it will never turn around, but that it's really going to be a while before it turns around.
That's Arlene Hirsch. She's been a career counselor since the early 80s, and lately she's seeing a change in her clientele.
I'm seeing a lot of young people probably graduating from college and into their mid, even late 20s. A lot of people, I think, are having trouble getting started or getting on a path.
Hirsch says young people face a disadvantage in the job market because of a lack of experience.
The difficulty in an economic downturn, then, is that there are less jobs available and more qualified people. So it's a little bit harder for people that don't have experience because they're actually competing with people who have more experience.
But she says young people who don't have to worry about responsibilities like children or a mortgage have an advantage. And Murphy, being young and single,
I don't need the $45,000, $50,000 job. And I think that's a big difference for organizations. You can get a same level caliber candidate, but one, you know, obviously has more compensation needs, so they could get me cheaper.
It's been close to 4 months since Murphy lost her job. Now she exercises regularly, reads more books, and has reconnected with friends, all while sending out resumes and going to interviews.
This has been an eye-opener for what I want professionally. I guess, in personal aspects, too. All in all, it's just taught me that you can never just become content with where you are.
Hirsch says that's one way people can use unemployment time to benefit themselves.
When you have some time away from that situation, you get some distance. It's easier, I think, sometimes to get a little better connected with what you really want. And so there's an opportunity to reevaluate. A lot of times people got on the wrong path or they knew it wasn't right, but they didn't know what else. And so you do have an opportunity to rethink and redirect.
For News and Notes, I'm Susie Yan.
And Susie Yan joins us now. Welcome, Susie.
Hi, Tony.
Nice job there. You know, we hear a lot about people who are out of work. We don't often hear as much about people who have either never been employed or, number one, are young enough that they're losing their very first jobs. What directed you toward this?
Well, as you know, being a young reporter, I know many young people. So a lot of my friends are going through this right now, either getting out of college and finding themselves in the workforce and not being able to get a job quickly. And some friends who have been on the job for a year or two, and they're the first to get laid off because they were last hired. So I just wanted to, show young people that, it's not all doom and gloom. I mean, it is tough out there, but as a young person, you do have some advantages, and it doesn't have to be so tough. You can use this as a time to benefit yourself and rethink what you want in your career path.
Well, good job. As I said, I want you to stick around because we're going to continue the conversation now with our reporters roundtable. Federal lawmakers are close to approving a multi-billion dollar stimulus package, and President Barack Obama's second pick for Commerce Secretary bows out of the job. Joining us today, John Yearwood, world editor at the Miami Herald, Laura Washington, a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and coming back with us, Susie Ahn, a freelance reporter for WBEZ in Chicago, whom we just heard. Hello, everybody. Nice to have you.
Hello, Tony.
Hi, Tony.
So we heard Susie's report, and it comes as the newest numbers show first-time unemployment claims dipped slightly last week, but the jobless rate is still the highest that it's been in almost 30 years. John, in your neck of the woods, how is unemployment affecting the community, particularly, if you know, as it relates to the younger people who are just getting started?
Well, Tony, unemployment in South Florida is high. I mean, in fact, much higher than in other parts of the state, and certainly I think much higher than we're seeing throughout the country. And I think some of the things that we're seeing here are similar to what we're seeing elsewhere, as Susie talked about. Particularly, if you're a young person getting your first job, you are clearly one of the first to be without a job as this climate, economic climate, worsens. So we're seeing some of the same thing here. And in fact, we had a story on the front page of the Miami Herald this morning about how the young people, and going even further than young people who are actually working, but young people who are going to school, are also who are homeless. In some cases because their parents don't have jobs.
You know, I would think, Laura Washington, you're there in Chicago with Susie Ahn, that not only is it bad for students coming out of college who are getting these jobs or not getting them, and then once they get them, losing them because they were the last hired, that they're coming out of college with this tremendous debt often from student loans.
Yes, and Tony, and that is you're absolutely right. I also teach at DePaul University, teach journalism there, and what I'm seeing is people having to make tough choices about the kinds of jobs and careers they choose. They come into school bright and bushy-tailed and excited about journalism careers, which is in and of itself is a pretty amazing thing given what's been happening in our field for the last several years. But by the time they get that diploma, they realize they can't afford to take a relatively low entry-level paying job. And in fact, many of my former students are bartending, you know, working in a coffee shop, working during the day in a temp agency. They're doing a variety of things just because they have not only just to keep eating, but also because they don't want that debt, that student loan debt to overwhelm them.
Well, you know, Susie, let me bring you back in to ask you this. We know that the 789, make it 790, if you like, billion-dollar stimulus package is about to be signed by the president. Part of that is supposed to be the Put People Back to Work projects, the so-called dirt and shovel projects. I'm wondering, from your standpoint, from the young people that you have encountered, are they looking forward to those kinds of jobs as an opportunity for them?
Well, some of the people I did talk to, you know, some people are just grabbing at whatever they can get. So, you know, I'm not sure if I can say that they're looking forward to it, but they are looking for whatever they can get. And then there are some others who, the woman I talked to in the piece, Eileen Murphy, you know, she was talking about how she at first was looking for anything that she could get. But then after, you know, being months out of the job, she took some time to rethink and thought, you know, I'm just going to look for the job that I want, even though this is a hard time. So I feel as a young person, it could go either way. I feel there's some people who are just desperate to get that job, but others who are using this time of unemployment to really seek out what they truly want in a career.
One of the things, John, that was an earmark of this legislative process was how unbipartisan it actually turned out to be. And one of the interesting side notes was that in your state, Florida, your governor, Charlie Crist, was one of those who was on board with the stimulus package. Do you think that there's going to be any political backlash for him and others who support it? Well, we know that there is for some, but do you think that there will be some for Charlie Crist because of his crossing the line?
Yeah. We're already seeing some backlash in that a number of Republicans in Florida are questioning his siding with President Obama on the stimulus package. But on the other hand, Charlie Crist is a political dynamo in Florida, and lasting impact of him siding with this, I don't think we're going to see that. And particularly if at the end of the day the economic stimulus package ends up making the economy a lot better. So, you know, he's up for re-election in a couple of years, and a lot of people here are saying that he is so popular as it is right now that any impact from supporting the president on this will not be lasting.
One of the interesting things, Laura Washington, about this, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina saying the other day, he was opposed to the stimulus package, but he is certainly going to take that money for his state.
The states are in desperate straits right now. Most of the states in this country cannot balance their budgets. They're desperate for revenues. Even in Illinois, where it's considering something that's been unthinkable till now, a statewide income tax increase. So they're going to take whatever money they can get.
I would assume that that would include the state of Illinois.
Absolutely. And even if they do get, I mean, I think that we're counting on some big money coming from Washington, particularly because Illinois is Obama's home state, President Obama's home state. But by the same token, no matter what our wish list is, it's not going to be enough to balance our budget. So we're in deep straits right now.
All right. What we're going to do, we're going to continue the conversation in a moment because we want to talk about the developments in commerce. As you know, President Obama's pick for Commerce Secretary Senator Judd Gregg has pulled his name from nomination. And as a result of that, there is a lot of finger pointing that is going on right now, whether or not Gregg embarrassed himself. Did he embarrass the president? Did the president embarrass himself by making a choice that was doomed from the beginning? Perhaps all of that we're going to discuss when we come back right after this. We're back with the Reporters Roundtable, talking with Laura Washington from Chicago, John Yearwood in Florida, and Susie Ahn also in Chicago. Let's pick up about the Commerce Secretary, Senator Judd Gregg, dropping out of the nomination for Commerce Secretary. One of the things, Laura Washington, that I've been seeing about this and reading all day today and yesterday as well is this. There is a sense that perhaps it was a noble idea on the part of the president, but not a very practical one to begin with.
I think that's correct. And even Judd Gregg himself said that when he announced that he was pulling out, that he didn't realize he was eager to serve, but he didn't realize what it would really mean for a Republican who's conservative on fiscal issues to step into the middle of this administration. And in fact, he said any administration. It's noble, but when you really get down to the brass tacks and he started looking at the stimulus plan, started looking at what the administration, where they were headed on a number of issues, and found that he just couldn't be there. So I think there's not any permanent damage done. I was really impressed with the way Gregg handled his departure. He was he was full of praise for Obama. He was full of praise for the stimulus plan. And even though many of fellow Republicans have been kind of beating up on it this week, he said, he was comfortable with where it was going. And he blamed himself for what happened. But it wasn't meant to be.
It seems to me, John Yearwood, that this gives the president an opportunity to perhaps step back from pushing for bipartisanship to the extent that he had been, and perhaps put a Democrat in there this time.
Well, Tony, I think you're absolutely right. I think what was heard in all of this is, the effort towards some kind of bipartisan consensus. I think what the public is beginning to see is that that's very difficult, which explains why so few presidents have wanted to go there. In this case, I don't anticipate that President Obama is going to step too far back because he is committed. But the more episodes like we've seen with Gregg, the more difficult everyone will see that this process is. And what I think is also unfortunate about this whole thing is that the Commerce Secretary is an important position within the cabinet. You may remember that Ron Brown pretty much transformed that office into quite an effective position. We have the census and other things that really need urgent attention, and I think it's one of those areas where I think the president ought to move quickly on to get a Commerce Secretary in place.
You're absolutely right. The late Ron Brown, as a matter of fact, was also the first African-American to hold that position. I believe that I'm correct in that.
Yes.
We've been talking about the economy all week, and we've been talking about foreign policy, and we've been talking about a number of things that weigh heavily on the public's mind. So we're going to end this week's edition of Reporters Roundtable on something that is a little lighter in content. It's about actress Selma Hayek. She went to Sierra Leone and breastfed a malnourished child in front of an ABC News camera crew, and this is what she said.
I thought about it. Am I being disloyal to my child by giving her milk away? And I actually think that my baby would be very proud to be able to share her milk. And when she grows up, I'm going to make sure that she continues to be a generous caring person.
So, Suzanne, sincere or publicity stunt?
Well, I have to say, Laura and I just looked at each other and kind of had a little silent laugh there. You know, I don't know if I would call it a publicity stunt, but I'm just not sure why, you know, this is why here in America we make this such an issue. I mean, I think it's bizarre, of course. I mean, I've never given birth to a child, so I don't know what that is like to, you know, that connection of breastfeeding. But I'm just not sure why ABC even had to air this, if why it had to be any importance on the news.
Well, it was celebrities. That's why we love our celebrities and we love their personal lives. It's like no one's ever breastfed a baby before. I found the whole thing really silly and in some ways kind of patronizing to children. You know, this poor little baby. I'm going to give this poor little African baby some of my good stuff. That was the way it came off to me.
All right. Well, that's a good way to end the program. I appreciate all of you. A good Reporters Roundtable. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Yearwood is the world editor at the Miami Herald, Laura Washington, a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times, and Susie Yan, a freelance reporter with WBEZ. Laura and Susie joining us from WBEZ in Chicago. Hot on the campaign trail, then-candidate Barack Obama routinely made promises that he would, quote, restore our moral standing in the world, end quote. So what are the early signs that this administration is unveiling a new era in diplomacy? Are we likely to see a foreign policy overhaul, and will dire economic concerns edge out progressive international relations? Joining us to answer some of these questions are Laurie Brand, professor of international relations and director of the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California, and Sandy Tolan, associate professor at USC's Annenberg School for Communication. Both of you, welcome to News and Notes.
Good to be with you.
Vice President Joe Biden ticked off a laundry list of foreign policy initiatives in an address at the Munich Conference on Security Policy last weekend. Russia, Iran, NATO, Gaza. The vice president took a sweeping view of foreign policy, promising a new era. So let's take a closer look. First, take the conflict in Gaza, Sandy. Do you think this was a squandered opportunity because the president some have been critical of him for not weighing in on that conflict more firmly and more immediately?
Well, you know, the president chose his first one of his first interviews with Al Arabiya, the Arab language television station, and clearly he said some things that he felt would indicate a change in tone, and clearly it does. He talked about offering a hand of friendship, the language we use matters, let's listen, we have to use the language of respect. These are all powerful messages in terms of shifting the tone. But what many people across the Arab world are waiting for is a sense that there will be a more even-handed policy. The arrival of George Mitchell is widely regarded in the Arab world as a positive thing because he's considered far more even-handed. But it's notable that there's still quite a bit of disappointment that President-elect Obama did not say anything really critical of Israel during the siege in Gaza, the war in Gaza, in which 1,300 Palestinians and 13 Israelis were killed. And in addition to that, there's a sense that even though George Mitchell is considered someone who's going to be more even-handed, he didn't say much of anything in his recent trip to the region about the expanding settlements.
Well, let me bring Laurie into the conversation because I was going to ask you about George Mitchell's presence there. And further, I was going to ask you how the outcome, in your opinion, of the Israeli elections are going to perhaps reshape the administration's Middle East strategy, particularly with it not being determined yet whether Netanyahu is going to be able to build the coalition party or whether Livni is going to be able to do so.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Sandy had to say. I think it's important that George Mitchell was appointed to this post as opposed to some of the other names that were circulating that were clearly much less, I'd say, even-handed. And in fact, the administration has received some criticism within the United States for the even-handedness that George Mitchell represents. This last trip of his out was supposed to be a listening tour, so I don't think there was any hope that he was going to come back with a lot of great plans. I think it was a chance more to sort of touch base with people. He did say that he's interested in opening an office in Jerusalem to deal with this issue on a day-to-day basis. And I think if that does take place, that's important, because I think it really does require a high-level presence, a high-level commitment, and a continued commitment and manifestation of that if we're going to have any progress. But your question about the Israeli elections is a very important one, because, in fact, of course, we don't know exactly what the outcome is going to be. It looks likely, even though Kadima won the largest number of seats, that in fact it will be Netanyahu who will end up being able to put a coalition together. The news this morning suggested that Livni hasn't had any luck in getting other coalition partners. So that raises a number of important questions, because when Netanyahu was last prime minister, we didn't have movement forward. In fact, we had stasis, in fact, or regression when it came to the peace process. Netanyahu was famous for the line, you know, peace in exchange for peace as opposed to land for peace, meaning basically no territorial concessions. And if there isn't going to be if there won't be territorial concessions, there really isn't a basis for a two-state settlement, which is what the United States, which is what U.S. policy is, and which Joe Biden reaffirmed in his statement in Munich.
If I could just add to that real quickly. I think one of the things, the results of this, and I agree with what Laurie was saying, I think we're going to see a sharp turn to the right in Israel, and I think this will essentially be, unfortunately, the death knell of the two-state solution. There has been so much physical change to the landscape in the West Bank, almost three times as many settlers as at the beginning of the Oslo process, 625 checkpoints in the West Bank, a land the size of Delaware. It's becoming increasingly hard to see how there could even be a two-state solution. And now with what Laurie cites as the reluctance to exchange land for peace, I don't see how there could be a two-state solution. I think eventually people are going to start looking at other options.
Let's move into another area. I want to ask both of you to respond to this. When you look at the mix of personalities representing the U.S. foreign policy team, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Richard Holbrooke, Mitchell, who we've mentioned, Defense Secretary Gates, and now Leon Panetta at CIA making up this team, what sort of internal dynamics could be in play here, and what impact are they likely to have on the president's foreign policy agenda, Laurie?
Well, I think it still remains to be seen. I don't think we have a good sense yet of what the dynamics are. A number of these people are former, are Clintonites, and so one would assume that the relationship with the Secretary of State would be good, although we know that Richard Holbrooke was angling himself for that appointment, so it's not clear exactly what that's going to mean. He does have a big portfolio and a crucial portfolio, so perhaps that in and of itself will be enough to sort of satisfy his desire for influence. George Mitchell, a bit older, kind of senior statesman type, and there's going to be plenty to keep him busy on the Arab or the Palestinian-Israeli front. What I'm interested to see is who is going to be appointed as the special envoy to Iran, because the administration has been making noises about having a special envoy there as well. And the name that has surfaced is that of Dennis Ross. I think that would be a terrible mistake for a number of reasons. He has no experience with Iran. His experience in dealing with Israeli-Palestinian affairs was one of not success, and I don't know why people keep talking about how experienced he is, but if the experience is all one of failure, I'm not sure that bodes very well. And then also just his very strong pro-Israel orientation in the work, I don't think really sets him up as an ideal person for that slot. So that, Iran is a critical portfolio as we go forward, and I hope that someone else will be chosen for that.
Let me put a different question to you, actually, Sandy, and it's this, because we just talked about Iran, and only a year ago, U.S. intelligence concluded that Iran had halted its nuclear work. There's still some question about whether or not that's true. We've also seen some early indications of opening overtures in terms of diplomatic negotiations with Iran over this. What is your perspective on how likely that is to happen?
Well, it's a bit early to say, but the initial indications are certainly more positive in terms of a potential dialogue being opened up. President Ahmadinejad sent a letter of a pretty conciliatory letter of congratulations to Barack Obama when he was elected, and there's been a draft, and I don't know at what stage it's at, but some of the language in the draft was also of the response from the Obama team And Secretary Clinton was also somewhat conciliatory, but there was also language about you have to stop being a pariah state. In turn, the Iranians might feel, and Ahmadinejad himself has asked for an apology for the U.S. Covert operation in 1953, which toppled a democratically elected government and installed the Shah. So I think there's a lot of sort of, among many Iranians, not just Ahmadinejad, a lot of sore feelings that there will be a genuine two-way dialogue. Whether or not this would end up being something that would have the Iranians truly stop their policy of moving towards nuclear weapons is something that remains to be seen.
Laurie, let's bring the conversation to a close with this. Certainly the Middle East will occupy the administration's attention right off the bat, as it has done. But how do you think other regions of the world will get prioritized in the foreign policy of the new administration? I'm thinking now about Russia, Venezuela, North Korea, Sudan, Somalia, for example.
Well, it certainly looks from initial indications that the Middle East is going to be the primary focus, although Russia, I think, as well, is clearly an area that the administration realizes there's some important bridge building or rebuilding to be undertaken with. And in large part because of the geostrategic nature of all this, the Russians can be important partners in trying to deal with some of these issues, which are really regional ones in kind of the Middle East to Central Asia. The Russians can be an important partner in dealing with Iran. They can be an important partner in trying to deal with Afghanistan. And I think that one good thing about this administration is they appear to understand, one, that they need to do policy reviews, and secondly, that we need to work in a multilateral way if some of these questions are going to be solved. I mean, we've moved away, thankfully, from the rhetoric of the war on terror to proclamations, I think, very clearly stated by Joe Biden in his statement that we're in need of partnerships to meet common challenges. And this is not a luxury. This is a necessity, he said. And certainly this is the case when it comes to dealing with what's continuing in Iraq and then the very large challenges looming in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
I would think, and we've got really less than 30 seconds for this, Sandy, that getting the economic problem solved first will be a big help to the president before he has to tackle anything on a major foreign policy scale.
Well, it's interesting to note that Dennis Blair, the director of national intelligence, is in the New York Times today and was in Washington yesterday talking about the number one in his threat assessment, the number one threat to the United States is the economy above everything else. And I think we may be looking at the possibility of a kind of a decline in what the writer Chalmers Johnson talks about, the decline in the American empire.
Well, I have to stop you there only because our time ran out. I appreciate you coming on. Thank you very much. Laurie Brand, Professor of International Relations and Director of the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California, and Sandy Tolan, Associate Professor at USC's Annenberg School. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Ending a relationship is never easy. The person breaking up often tries to use words to soften the blow. I'm not ready to be in a committed relationship, or it's not you, it's me. And the person being dumped is left trying to figure out just where things went wrong. A year ago, author Rachel Skerrit decided that she wanted to get to the bottom of all of her ex-boyfriend's vague explanations for ending their relationship. So she called the men in her past and asked them to tell her exactly why they stopped wanting to be with her. Rachel joins me now. Welcome to News and Notes, Rachel.
Thanks, Tony.
Rachel, why in the world would you want to know this?
Well, I'm a tough cookie. I should say that first off, but I'm also a writer. And the idea came to me after that whole he's just not that into you phenomenon, the book, not the movie. And a lot of my friends were reading it as if they'd found, you know, the answers to everything. Oh, he's just not that into me. That explains it. But there was this whole missing why piece, why not? And as you said, guys seem trained to give these stock answers so as not to hurt feelings, but I really wanted the real deal.
All right, so what did you find out?
Well, it was a lot of fun. Some of it was tough to take, very much an educational experience, and I was overwhelmed by how different people's answers were. But I found a lot of useful information. One of the recurring themes was their needing someone who was a little bit more nurturing and someone who had kind of a softer, compassionate side. And that was a little difficult to take because I actually work in high schools. I'm a high school principal, so I consider myself a very compassionate person. But I had to realize about myself that sometimes I was kind of turning off the visible compassionate button once I left the school building. So that was really educational.
I don't know if this makes a difference or not, and I'm trying to be careful about not getting too far into your personal business. But are we talking about, you know, one boyfriend, two boyfriends? Are we talking about five boyfriends, ten boyfriends?
I should clarify that not everyone was a boyfriend. I was really just talking to all the guys that I knew over the last, let's say, 8 years. And so those obviously weren't all people whom I dated. Some were friends who we decided to be friends instead of dating. And I thought that their perspective was equally important because, you know, a lot of times men will have women in their lives who they put into different boxes, you know, potential wife box, just a friend box. And so really I was asking those people, what makes you decide to put me in that certain box? So not everyone I spoke to was actually an ex. They were men that I knew.
So did you do this face-to-face, over the phone, email, Facebook?
How'd
you do this?
Mediums. So some of them were face-to-face meetings. A couple were on the phone, and then one person felt more comfortable emailing me.
I guess
that was actually the toughest one.
I guess I have to ask you this as our time comes to a close. Was it worth putting yourself through that to get what you got on the other end?
It absolutely was, but I have to warn anyone who's thinking about it that you have to have some distance from the men in your past in order to really make it a positive experience. If this is someone that you're still hoping to reconnect with or you're still hurt by, you may not be ready to have the conversation. I was very distant, so for me it was very positive, and I'm also a pretty self-confident person, so I knew I wouldn't be broken by it. So I'm pleased, but I would put a caution tag on it for anyone who doesn't quite feel ready.
Would you do it again?
Sure. I actually got a lot of friends out of it, people that I'd lost touch with, and we had such good conversations that, you know, we have a new relationship in a friendship umbrella. So I'm really happy with it.
Now, there was no one that you broke up with friendship-wise or beyond, and I'll ask you this really quickly, that you decided you wanted to connect with again after you found out what they thought you did wrong.
No, if anything, it was more of a turnoff. I realized that we definitely should never have been a match.
You remember what
I heard the answers.
You remembered what the problem was once you saw them again, right?
Remembered and refreshed it. It clarified it.
Rachel, you have more nerve than I do, I'll tell you that. Thank you very much. This is fascinating and an interesting thing to do on Valentine's Day for sure.
Thank you so much. And I have an article about it on TheRoot.com today.
Thank you. That was novelist Rachel Skerritt. She is the author of When the Lights Go Down. You can read her latest article, Exit Interviews with My Eyes, on our website, nprnewsandviews.org.
No loud speakers, but I'm speaking loud vernacular.
And now a bit of poetic commentary from the one and only funk master George Clinton. Today's topic, the war on drugs.
U.S. Custom Coast Guard dope dog, nicknamed Bustum. Like most dope-sniffing dogs, he's got a habit, trained to have it. Pick up the tracks of the traffickers and track them like a rabbit up the coastline. Canine control substance retriever, receiver of the Golden Nose Award for leading them to the cash, cashing in on the stash. Now he's in line for his issue of the booty. Never do he do a line in the line of duty. He's a dope dog, a U.S. Custom Coast Guard dope dog. Keen sense of smell, tracking the telltale trails of cartel dope boats. Big dope, never a gram or OZ kilo too low key. Gotta be tons of Piblo, bales of lumbo. While other dogs are sniffing one another's tail, he can track the profit from a dope sale straight to the stink account. Big banks, banking on laundered dirty money not stinking. As the wind blows, he get a whiff, he take a sniff, he just follow his nose. OMAC uncle had some drugs, C-I-A-I-O, and with those drugs he bought some arms, C-I-A-I-O. There was a bang bang here and a snort snort there, here bang, there snort, banging snorts everywhere. OMAC uncle starts a war, C-I-A-I-O.
Before we go any further, maybe we should explain. When musician George Clinton came to visit our show, we asked him to tell us what was on his mind. And, well, that's what came out. And it went on.
An undercover narc with a bark took a bite out of crime. Posing as a CNI dog, he bit the blind. The man with the cane made of coke. As sure as the dope boats float, the media goes comatose. Unrelated over-the-counter overdose now become drug-related. Aided and abetted by a lot of apprehension and indifference. The bigger the headache, the bigger the pill. Y'all can take your medicine now, because you're going to be ill when I tell you the deal on dope. There is more profit in pretending that we're stopping it than selling it. Roof.
George Clinton is in his late 60s now, and after more than 50 years at it, he and his P-Funk All-Stars are still party favorites with young and old alike. His latest CD is called George Clinton and His Gangsters of Love. It's a look back at some of the old school classics that inspired him most when he was just getting started. We wanted to talk with him about it and about the amazing Everything But the Kitchen Sink musical universe that he managed to get us all dancing in. So here's a trip into the mind of the P-Funk master himself, George Clinton.
Staying way too long and I can't do without you. Every chance you get seems to hurt me more and more.
Well, I've been waiting to do this for a long time because doo-wop was my first love. And all the songs of the 50s and 60s, you know, is music is... need something different right about now. So I say, let me see if I can do some singing of love songs. And when I started doing that, I started thinking about love. In the 50s, the fellas didn't mind getting on one knee. They said, darling, I love you. You know what I'm saying? But today you got to keep your gangster on. You know, you know what I'm saying? It's a whole other thing, and they're still in love. They're still in love. It don't sound like it, but they get married and they have children like everybody else do. I ain't trying to school them because it's done changed already. It's too late for school them. I got to learn. You know what I'm saying? Matter of fact, I was on the elevator, and I heard the guys on there, they was cursing, and the young girls was on there. I said, man, won't y'all be cool? The ladies on there. She said, oh, here go Captain Save-A-Ho. I'm like, uh-oh, let me get my gangster on and figure out how to talk like this. Oh, I'm a Smokey fan, you know, as far as the writer is concerned. And Marvin gave me the song, and it was always a song that I thought it was one of the best written songs, the lyrics in that. And so I had to do that one. Started out about 14. We saw Frankie Lyman doing his thing and girls screaming. Oh, of course I'm going to have some of this. You know, and skip school to go to the Apollo. And see the Spaniards, the Flamingos, and Jackie Wilson, Clyde McFadden in the 50s. I mean, we watched everybody. You know, right up to the 60s when Smokey and the Miracles and the Temptations blew into town. Motown came out. That was the new doo-wop. And I went straight to work for them and did that until we got our first hit record. It was in 66. I Want to Testify. By the time we got our hit record, doo-wop was over again. But here come the English groups coming over here doing what we had done, what our mothers liked, the blues and the Shake It Up, Baby. We was on our way to the Copa in Las Vegas. We were trying to be, ritzy, but then we met them guys coming over with jeans and torn up shirts. We was talking about hippie. But we knew how to be hippie. We knew how to be, like raggedy. So we went back, got us some diapers and sheets off the Holiday Inn bed and we went crazy on them. Got our mind blown out. You know what I'm saying? Tripped on out of here and we didn't come back. Temptations on Acid, we were gone. Because we had missed the beginning of this psychedelic era. We had to catch up. So we went totally nuts. Took the amps all the way up and went out. And pretty soon we were, we made it like it was brand new. Slowly coast on back into, the mothership connection. This is a chance. playing GC at the time, and there's so many Afros as far as you could see, and then a bunch of hippies, all in this concert we had, and you look out over the hill, somebody said, One Nation Under a Girl. She said, wow, young, they come to see y'all, and they're like, One Nation Under a Girl. We took that and went right to the studio and recorded that concept. We're dancing our way out of our constrictions. More of what you're fucking with. That's going to be our redeemer. Dancing our way around all the problems. Ain't nothing wrong. We'll be all right by Thursday.
You're listening to the riffings of funk master George Clinton. Clinton has had epic fights with record companies over the use of his music. He's been a major inspiration to hip-hop, and he just may be the most sampled musician of all time. But Clinton says he has rarely been paid proper royalties.
And it's not against the artist that did it. It's the record companies that took it out of the artist's royalties and didn't give it to us. I got some of them back. I got One Nation back, Knee Deep. Got those back. But there's a lot of other ones and a lot of other monies that are over $150 million worth. But we're not going to sweat and cry over it. If somebody sample our record, make a new record, we're going to sample theirs back.
Yeah, this is a story of famous dog. But the dog that chases its tail will be busy.
They was not going to let that record be it was selling all the time. It ain't never stopped selling. But that's when they decided that they weren't going to give us our money. They told us right then, it's not going gold. It's not going to be gold. It never went gold as far as they're concerned. They still tell us it never went gold. And we all know that. And some people have bought the record 100 times. They bought the plastic, the CD, now download it. You know what I'm saying? It's so many records sold, but they still claim that it never sold gold. Look on the wall of Tupac, 16 million records, and he sampled Atomic Dog. Same thing with somebody else. We all know better than that, but it's catching up to him. That one give you excuse to go nuts. And that with the dog in you, instincts are set free. You're allowed to do all that animals do. You know, you put thinking on hold for a minute. And the tongues come out and they wagging and they everything they see is a tree. Just give you the excuse to go crazy. Change the cat. Flashlight will give you an excuse to jump up on the dance floor and then knee deep will do the same thing. But Tommy Dog, you ain't got to know how to dance at all. You can just like jump you behind on out on the floor and do the butterfly or the caterpillar, whichever you want to do. But you do the best you can, and you're all right then.
My motto is
make my the people. I'm on my fuck gun cut. Yeah, make my fuck the people. I want to get fucked up.
George Clinton, his life and times in his own words. Clinton's latest CD is called George Clinton and His Gangsters of Love. One last thought from the funk master. We asked what he would want people to say about him years after he's gone. He says, seeing that he was literally born in an outhouse, his epitaph should read,
his mother thought it. She had to go to the bathroom when he was born. He was destined to be funky.
You can watch video of this interview on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org.